morning, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen. I had I had hoped that we could, and perhaps we still can, finalise the State Liability Amendment Bill this week. Now, it means that we have to try as far as possible to ensure that all of us are on board and the one hand knows what the other is doing. Just a few household matters. First, before I go any further, Vunani Ramano's father's brother passed away. When he informed me last week, on your behalf, I asked him to convey our sympathies to the family, which he's promised to do. That's why he's not with us today. The honourable mentor is running late due to traffic. It's just one apology. I'm not aware of any others. So that's in as far as that is concerned. We had also asked for Treasury to join us this morning because their input on this bill is very important. In fact, it's crucial. Initially they had agreed, and then I was informed by Mr. Labuskagni this morning that they then turned around and said they weren't able to attend today, but they will be with us tomorrow. So we'll have to just roll with all these punches and see how we can best deal with the matter. Bearing in mind at all times, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, that we do have a constitutional court deadline that we must meet. And that deadline doesn't simply apply to this committee or to the National Assembly, it applies as much to the National Council of Provinces and the Presidency. Because when Parliament has finalized its consideration of legislation, it must go to the President. And quite often many of us assume that when it lands on the President's desks, he simply signs it. He doesn't. He needs time, or his office does need time to make sure that we've done the right thing and that it meets constitutional muster. So, I ask that you bear all these things in mind as we proceed. I'm going to ask, you will all have received the legal opinion which we requested from the Chief State Law Advisor, the one that dealt with the dilemma we were faced with around immovable and movable property. I assume that all of you have read the opinion, and so with that in mind, I'm now going to ask Mr. Labuskagni to just recap for us where we are. Yeah. Sorry, JJ.
Can you explain the documentation to us? I'm a little bit distressed that one has a see, it's now called a working document, but it's got the same reference number date as the summary of submissions document, which is 303.11HH. But anyway, could you maybe just also explain those? My difficulty is, and it's more aimed at the committee section, that when you come here, you get given documents. And very often members do come without their documents, so they do need to be given documents that they may have been given before. But those of us who do prepare, it's problematic that we're just sort of somewhat given a document and nobody knows what it is and why we weren't given it before. So That's a concern. And then, Chair, the other thing, while I'm at it, is the notice we got said 9 o'clock. There was an SMS that came out, I think, yesterday, which said 10 o'clock, which is when we've in fact met. Why do we have to go through this? You know, why can't the committee section organize a time and keep to it? Usually we meet at 10 o'clock on a Tuesday. So, what's the point of this? So can we get an explanation on that too, please? So I'd like to know, why were we not given, when did committee section get this document that we've just been given now? Why were we not given it before? And then can I have an explanation as to the time? You know, I see there's another notice here which says 10. I've got one that says 9, one that says 10. But why was it ever 9 in the first place?
Mr. Jeffrey, the committee secretary who has joined us to replace Mr. Vanani, is not in a position to respond. I must assume that it's as a result of Vanani having to rush off to the funeral, and in the process matters got mixed up. I can only apologize to you and ensure that it doesn't happen again. But your point about documents is very relevant. I've just had a word with one of the officials about that. You can't give us a document now and then expect us to have another one in 35 minutes' time and then yet another one in another 15 minutes' time after that. Because it doesn't help us one single bit. We will be receiving a document any minute now, which is relevant to what we are discussing. But let's see how we move forward, Mr. Lipscott.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I need to apologize for Mr. Rutman on the content today. That's the urgent business in Victoria. Then, Chairperson, we are a big team today. There are three state board advisors sitting there at the back. Then Mr. Gabula from the G-Interpretations Office, in the office of the department. And then Mr. Wilken and Mr. Manuel from the office of the State Attorney. I invited them to...
When the people are referred to, can we see who they are rather than trying to guess?
My apology, Chairperson. You're sitting next to him, and then the State Board Advisors, please introduce yourself.
Chairperson, I'm Karen Boyce from the State Board Advisors.
I am Mohamed Lukweta, State Board Advisors Office Chair. Thank you.
Morning, I'm Susan Masapu from the State Board Advisors Office, Pretoria. Thanks.
Mabel Gowler from the Department of Justice, Pretoria.
And I'm your honour, Scott. Okay, Chairperson, then, as far as the documents are concerned, I must apologise to one on the summary of submissions. I worked on that one till about 7 o'clock this morning, and I then sent it to the committee clerk. That's why the committee, or members of the committee, did not receive it earlier. I also made perhaps a mistake. I should have indicated the date, because if you look at the other working document, it clearly provides as on 19/4/2011, which is today's date. So I should have perhaps included the same date on the summary of submissions. So my apology for that if I have confused the committee members. Chairperson, at the previous meeting, the committee raised a few issues and requested various people to provide inputs, for example, the State Board Advisors, on the issue of immovable property, Treasury, on their involvement in the order of the Nyati judgment. Then also an input was requested from our Chief Litigation Officers Unit. Mr. Kabula will present that input once we have received the later document that I believe is indicated should be here within the next few minutes. I have in the meantime, Chairperson, also started to work, or actually not started, I've been working on the submissions and preparing responses. One of the documents that were distributed this morning contains my proposed amendments to the bill emanating from the submissions that they have received. So I will go through that once we get to that issue. I need to point out that the input that we might receive from finance may have major implications on what I'm proposing at the moment. So before, I think it's vital for us to get that input as soon as possible. I don't know when it will be submitted to the committee. I've been in contact with officials and they said to me that they're still in the process of it's not say finalizing it, but they're in the process of finalizing the input. So Chairperson, I don't know, I don't want to prescribe the process in the committee, but I would like to suggest that we start with the main issue, and that is the issue of immovable property, and then request the state law advisors to give us an explanation on opinion that they have given us and how they came to the conclusion. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. We've prepared a opinion which was circulated, and I believe honourable members are in possession of the opinion. We were asked during the last meeting of the Portfolio Committee to consider the question whether the bill as certified is constitutional in light that it provides only for the attachment of movable property in respect of the relevant state department, but excludes from its ambit the immovable property. We've looked at the Nyati judgment, State Liability Act, and the fact that there are various matters raised in the Nyati judgment regarding the particular matter. On page 2 in our discussion, we indicated that the question that needs to be answered in respect of the Nyati judgment is whether the bill provides for an express procedure for the satisfaction of judgment debts against the state. And there the court has indicated that Section 3 limits the rights in the Constitution. If there's a limit, that limitation must be reasonable and justifiable. The court also stated that Section 3 does not positively oblige the state to comply with court orders as it should, and it effectively places the state above the law in violation of Section 8, in the sense that the applicant was not treated for the recognition of his worth and importance of a human being. And for this reason, the court then held that the Section 3 violates the right of dignity and so limits the equality. But that also needs to be taken into account with all of the other sections of the Constitution as well, and that we will embark on further in the opinion. Now, the respondents argue that Section 3 of the Act limits any rights, but then this limitation is justified where the limitation serves a legitimate and acceptable purpose, and there's sufficient proportionality between the harm done by the legislation and the good sought to be achieved. And I think what's of importance is when the court then interpreted Section 3 of the Act and outlined its shortcomings. That's on page 3 of our opinion. And it's bulleted there at the bottom of page 3. Chairperson, do you want me to go through the whole of the opinion, or can I just highlight some of the issues? Thanks. So a step-by-step analysis was done by the court of the particular section. And the proposed amendments to the section then introduces a new procedure in the bill that enables the judgment creditor to enforce a final court order sounding in money against the state should the state fail to pay within the stipulated time frame. And in this instance, specifically clause 3, subclause 4, 5 and 6 of the bill provides for the procedure. And I think that's important, that there is a procedure then outlined in the state liability proposed bill, wherein a judgment creditor will be enabled to know what must be done. Clause 3, in our view, has improved the situation. It has identified that the state attorney or attorney of record was responsible for informing the accounting officer about the final court order against the department, and if also such payment must be paid within 30 days unless there is an appeal lodged. In contrast of the previous one, there was a blanket prohibition of attachment and execution of state property, but the new proposed clause 3 in our view permits then the attachment and execution of state property except for obviously the immovable property. What we've done then is we've also looked at the onus that's on the accounting officer to pay the judgment creditor the money stipulated in the final court order. If the accounting officer fails to pay the money within the stipulated 30 days, he or she may be charged with misconduct in the Public Finance Management Act. And the sheriff will be able to attach the property after 30 days if no application for stay is brought. And that's in terms of the proposed bill. The proposed amendments of Section 3 in our view expands extensively on the existing Section 3 of the Act, which lacked any process for the satisfaction of judgment debts against the state. The new clause provides for a step-by-step process to ensure that the claim of the judgment creditor is ultimately satisfied. In our opinion, these provisions sufficiently then provides address for the issue of satisfaction of judgment debts against the state by providing for a specific or express procedure for satisfaction. What we've also looked at is we've looked at the right to equality as a fundamental right provided for in the Bill of Rights, but since these rights are not absolute, they may be limited, and Section 36 of the Constitution provides for such limitation, and it now remains to then determine whether that such limitation is reasonable and justifiable. And in that instance, we've looked at the Brumar case, which we outlined on page 6, where we said that the limitation must be reasonable and justifiable, but the regard must be had to factors such as the nature of the right limited, the purpose of the limitation, including its importance. And I think that's important for our purposes as well. But then specifically and of very importance is the fact that the Constitution requires and mandates the states to provide basic services to people. People have rights to basic services guaranteed by the Constitution. And though the bill limits the attachment and execution of all states' property by excluding the execution of immovable property, this ensures that the state ultimately then has the necessary resources to ensure service delivery, and the state attachments are not attached to the disadvantage of other individuals. So that's also a balancing right that we need to take into account. We also looked in that instance to the Modderclip-Boudreau case, where there's an obligation imposed by the state, and we've highlighted that particular bit in page 7 on 2.222. What we said is today, the comments made in Modderclip case apply to the execution of against the state as well and demonstrate the importance of ensuring that there's no disruption of service delivery, and I think that's critical on the part of the state. The state must function effectively and efficiently in fulfilling its constitutional obligation and cannot do so if its assets are attached. In our view, the attachment and the execution of any immovable state property could result in large-scale disruptions, as indicated by the words of Justice Mutlala in the Nyati judgment, severe disrupt service delivery and unjustified limit of the rights of many under other individuals can result as a result of this. This ultimately would prevent the state from fulfilling its constitutional mandate by providing services to the people. So having taken all of that into account, we've mentioned a few other cases like the Bulwana, the Manamela case, and we conclude then on page 9, where we said that the balance is required between the right of an individual to attach and execute state property in satisfaction of a judgment debt granted in his or her favor and the rights of other individuals to realize their rights as contained in the Constitution. In our conclusion, we say that the Constitutional Court did not mention the issue of whether state immovable property may be attached, but we hold the view that the exclusion of immovable property from of the state from attachment and execution is justifiable in terms of the law, and we are of the opinion that it does not render the bill unconstitutional. Thank you, Chairperson.
Questions for clarity?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just, I hear the point, and it's not exactly the same situation, but I mean, surely there are also situations in private businesses where essential services are delivered, for example, hospitals, private hospital companies, and so on. Would it not then open us up to, or open it up for them to say, well, then we are also providing essential service, I guess not constitutionally mandated, maybe, but on those grounds, we should also then be exempt from this provision. I don't buy that argument that the equality overrides that.
Chairperson, I think we're dealing here with a different scenario, if I may. We're dealing here with the state and the obligation of the state to realize people's right. And I think it's a right that is necessary, and we need to ensure that we don't disrupt services of the state to render services to the community, and that I think is the important aspect that we need to concentrate on. Thank you, Chair.
Just a quick follow-up. I mean, surely there are some kinds of state property where it's not necessarily going to disrupt services. For example, government houses and stuff like that.
The private hospital analogy is not a good one in that you have a choice whether you want to go to a private hospital or not. Any private body can go belly up, can go bankrupt. There shouldn't be anything protecting it just because it's a private hospital. Whereas the state, people of South Africa have an expectation and a right to access to health care. Obviously, there would be state property that could be seized, but I think the issue is for me the questions are: do we have to provide for the attachment of immovable property? And the response from the state law advisors is no, we don't. It then becomes a political question of should we? Now, even on the question of, okay, the Bar Council, I think it was feeling that we should constitutionally. But my view is that, look, I mean, there's many points in law that are moot. This one probably, like many others, also moot. I don't like, personally, from a policy point of view, I don't like having a movable property included for attachment. I mean, yeah, look, maybe Leeuwenhof is not an essential piece of property, and I think if I recall correctly, the Premier of the Western Cape took some time to move into it because she preferred her house. than the residents, but it's a historic piece of land. Should somebody be able to attach and execute the sale of Parliament? So I policy-wise, I don't like it, and I would have thought I would really want to argue that let's exclude it. I don't think I haven't heard any compelling arguments that it should be included from a constitutional viewpoint. Sure, it's a matter that could end up in the Constitutional Court, but rather let it go there. I mean, I'm relatively confident that there's a strong argument for why it shouldn't be included. And let's not preempt the courts by doing things we don't necessarily want to do. So my view would be, I think I've heard the arguments. I would want to propose that we proceed without the inclusion of immovable property. And if it comes up later, well then so be it, but let's not preempt the courts doing something that we're not, most of us I think, are not particularly keen about.
Chairperson, my question is more, if we decide not to include immovable property, what happens in the event of a shortfall after attachment of movable property? I think that we also need to clarify that in the bill, because we cannot now say it will never happen. We just have to make provision for that. And my proposal, I know that in the last meeting we have decided as a committee that one accounting officer of a department should not be held liable for another accounting officer's mistakes, if I can put it like that. But if that is the way that we can think in terms of what happens if we do have a shortfall, then maybe we must look at that. But we can't just say just move the property and that's that. Because then obviously the bill is not going to address all the problems that we are facing.
Perhaps that is where Treasury comes in. Their input in this particular discussion becomes important. But do you want to come in, Dean?
At your invitation, just to say that I've always been satisfied with movables. That is also the position in the Nyati 2 judgment, the interim procedure. And I've always been satisfied with that.
Do you think that the point raised by Advocate Adams is relevant? In the event of a shortfall, we take the point that another head of organ of state can't be made liable for the actions of one of his colleagues. I think there's agreement there. And I think there's also agreement, Debbie, that no matter how we feel about Leeuwenhoek's, Sicelo Shtega, and Parliament or the House in the Eastern Cape, you're going to have it's going to be like the gold rush in the days of the wild wild west, you know, and we can't have that. So what do we do in the event of a shortfall is a matter that we need to flag, okay, so that when Treasury does appear, perhaps they can provide us with a possible solution. Yes, sir.
Thanks, Chair. Let me also take the Honourable Member's point further, that what recourse or what provisions can we put into the bill in a situation whereby the judgment creditor has no recourse, for example, against a particular hospital, because all the assets in that particular hospital are regarded as would disrupt services, would threaten life, would put security of the country into disrepute, and that there is no other assets available that could be realized in satisfying that debt.
You see, this is an issue I try to have the Accountant General address us on. I am aware that this is on another, in another committee I served on, that a particular entity was faced with court action. And the Auditor General said, you need to set aside money in the event the court rules against you. And you haven't done so. Now, at the last meeting, the Accountant General sort of treated it flippantly. But as I understand it, that can be done. Because you don't want a situation where the DG turns around and says, well, we didn't budget for it. Which deals with the shortfall raised by Advocate Adams. Whereas if the department set the money aside and ring-fenced it, so that in the event the court rules against the department, it has funds. What happens today is that it goes along, and then when it exhausts appeals, it says, well, we didn't budget for it. You can't have that situation. JJ.
Now, just from a progress point of view, I'd want to suggest, I mean, look, maybe one thing on a lighter note, I did think in that we maybe should exempt ESCOM in the light of their submission supporting the attachment of immovable property. I thought we should maybe exempt ESCOM from the restriction on immovable property attachment. But then I think that would fall foul of the equality clause, so but that was on a lighter note. No, I just was very surprised with the ESCOM submission to that effect. But basically from a progress point of view, Chair, I'd want to suggest that we put the issue of immovable property aside. We've resolved it. We are not going to allow the attachment of immovable property. But we then need to take Ms. Adams's point into account, and that would really follow the procedure. So I agree with you, we need to flag it. And I think it's unfortunate that Treasury are not here, given the time limits that we are operating under. And hopefully they will be here tomorrow, but yeah, otherwise we will have to finalize the bill without them. And from my side, as you know, I'm very sympathetic to the Mahoro procedure, which Treasury aren't that happy with, but if they're not here to say why it shouldn't be implemented, that's their problem.
And you know, to pick up your point, and it is the answer to Ms. Adams's, Honourable Adams's concern, no self-respecting public entity would not take a provision if it was engaged in litigation, and they all are, some more than others, and court cases take a number of years. No self-respecting entity is not going to take a provision and cater for a ruling against them. So it's not some big deal, and government departments can learn to do the same, exactly as you suggest, sir. And then that has to come out of what we have voted for them, and they'll have to learn to behave better so that they don't fall short of funds.
Well, we've set aside immovable property. Well, heave a big sigh of relief, Mr. Lapskov, as well as Mr. Okay, your amended document, we're still waiting, Mr. Nabula. So, that being the case, where does that leave us now?
Well, Chief, listen, I think the only other option that we then have is to start working through this summary of submissions. But it's unfortunate because I think Mr. Kabuda's document could give some further light on what is contained in my summary and my responses, but I think let's start working through the document. I'm sure it will take us more than today to do it, because the committee will deliberate and are prepared. We are, I support these submissions are prepared already for amendments. But again, Treasury's input is vital, because that especially now that the committee has decided we're not going to be in immovable property option, so they will have to come up with a way to provide for their involvement, or because one of the commentators indicated that what happens if the department say that all my movable assets fall in that category of exclusion. So that's why it's very important for us to come up with a alternative mechanism, if I can call it like that. But we definitely need their input, because that was the committee's request at the previous meeting. So they had to then surely go and apply that in their mind. Maybe it's, I think, as far as they are concerned, this is a major policy issue, which that they maybe will have to clarify with their minister. I don't know. Unlike some of the other proposed amendments, which are technical, not that major, because we must keep in mind what we now all of a sudden want. What we want to do is to involve a department who was never previously involved, although the RT judgment includes them, but the bill doesn't. So to summarize, I think let's start to work through this document and let's then see how far we get, unless the committee has any other suggestions.
Just a couple of things. This working document of yours, does Treasury have it now?
Chairperson, because I also found out that one only this morning, so that they don't have it. But what is in that document won't affect the input.
And does you haven't received Mr. Gavula's document? Because as I see it now, you all need to be talking to one another, and you all need to be on the same page. Okay. We don't want a situation where come tomorrow or Thursday, and the committee is ready now to formally consider the bill clause by clause, that one of you jumps up and say, hang on a second, we're not ready for this. That's the only thing that is... Well, that's why I said to Mr. Kavula, you know, you can't bring documents to us on an ad hoc basis. It doesn't help us. Because we have a document here now, and I've said to Mandy she mustn't distribute it because there's now an amended version of it. So, all right.
Why is it that we haven't been given documents? On our last meeting on sustainability, we were some time ago, where we are working under quite a tight deadline, as well as having other responsibilities.
Chairperson, no, I just want to make one point. As far as my documents are concerned, I've been working on this on a 90% basis since our previous meeting. Some of these one-line proposals took me 3, 4, 5 hours to do some research. So it's not a matter that you can go and sit and decide yes or no. So I had to do some research, and that is why the document was not made available previously.
Yes, Jan is correct, and my document basically is trying to respond to the challenges between the parties, the judgment creditor and the judgment debtor, in terms of giving effect to the interim order by that Nyati matter. What I then had to do, because our state attorney's offices are spread throughout the country, I had to rely to get information from them. And the information was coming on ARGOC basis and so on. I've managed to get the final document yesterday. But the current document that you have in front of you, the only difference with the one that we're waiting for is that I've requested them to sort of give a summary of the facts in respect of each case, what happened. But the process and the procedure as required in terms of the interim order, is there. And lastly, my humble apologies to Mr. Jefferson, members of the committee, to cause you to have to wait for the document until it's finalized.
Thanks. If this is a summary of submissions you want to take us through, and we've had that before. But I don't know. Honourable members, let me leave that in your laps.
Okay, I mean, maybe we could look. Can we have any explanation from our treasury? I mean, where are they?
No, there's no explanation.
And that they weren't able to attend today, but they will be able to attend tomorrow. Were we told today? No, they were told last week about the meeting.
Because look, I don't think it is a new issue. It's in the Maporo judgment. So it's a new thing. It's presumably, I mean, and that's what the Maporo's document will tell us about how it's been implemented. I think it has been, am I correct, Mr. Labuschagne, an issue that has been considered by the executive around the role of Treasury, that Treasury were not keen on. I mean, my understanding is that there wasn't a consensus on excluding them. Okay, I don't want to get into more. But basically we have to proceed. And we've given them the opportunity. The bill is with Parliament, or with the National Assembly. The Minister of Justice, no other minister, has got the power to withdraw it if he wants. We proceed. But I would suggest, Chair, that what we do is we go through Mr. Labuschagne's document, we deal with the sections that do not need... I mean, my understanding is Mr. Kaula's document is also talking about the implementation of the Maporo order. We deal with the sections that don't relate to that and then come back to them tomorrow, and if there's no Treasury tomorrow, well, we finalise them.
Listen, may I, with your permission, be excused, say for a minute, I just want to phone people of Treasury to confirm whether they will be here tomorrow, number one, and secondly, to find out when will they be able to submit their submission to the committee so that we don't face the same...
You want to get it tomorrow when they're walking in.
That's what I want to try and avoid. Okay. So, if you will allow me to quickly go and speak to them.
Sure.
Thanks.
Thank you. $10 in your hand.
Tomorrow, and hopefully get the opportunity to see the document.
chairperson, that is correct. I did receive an input from them on an informal basis, but it was clearly stated that that input is subject to their minister's approval. So that's why before the minister has approved, I didn't pay that much attention. And that's why I said, I mean, the minister may totally differ from what they are proposing. So as far as that issue is concerned, my personal view is that we cannot move forward before we have an approved input from the, or an input that has been approved by the minister. That's my view.
No, not in disagreement with that.
I was just hoping for some kind of insight into... but Chair, then maybe back to the original suggestion of Ms. Lubberskaft, and he takes us to his document, but leaving out the issues, the aspects that are affected by the role of Treasury. Huh?
Once you're done, Mr. Lubberskaft, then we've received Mr. Gavula's now amended document. Once you're done with yours, then we move on to his.
Sorry, I would like to suggest that we first deal with these, because mine will take us maybe the whole day, or even longer. Because, I mean, as we go along, the committee will need to some proposals I do not support, or the department does not support. So the committee must then decide whether the committee is going to support or not. And I've also prepared draft amendments, which we must put together with the summary of submissions. That's why I said it will definitely take us some time to move through this document.
Thanks, this document simply provides the Honourable Committee with challenges since the order, an interim order that was made by Honourable Justice Mokgoro on this matter. If we look at the one in Mafikeng, the first one there on top, SS Mutupi, the plaintiff in that matter, is that it took the state almost 1 year to effect payment. In other words, from the date of the judgment, that the order was made on the 1st of October 2009 until final effect of payment 11 October 2010. That's one point. The second one is, in most, my colleagues, Mr. Wilkins and Emmanuel can add more on this thing. You'll find in most cases client departments contract particular services, and then a dispute arises in terms of implementing or performance in respect of that contract between the two parties. And in most cases you'll find client departments not wanting to pay because the other party has not performed in total. And there are many of those type of disputes in various client departments. In other words, you'll find client departments withholding back certain payments because performance in terms of the agreement has not been made and so on. And then you'll find the applicant then will proceed to issue summons. And in this case, particularly...
Sorry to interrupt. Can I just offer clarity? Are you saying that they contract outside companies?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And in this case, also as I raised the challenges regarding holding the responsibility on the state attorney or the attorney of record in that matter, it's going to be difficult for state attorneys, or for state attorneys in particular, if we have to ensure that or inform the accounting office in the particular department to certify a particular debt when we were not involved in that particular matter. And the second one, it was clearly the case where we were not in
initially involved, but when an order was then made, it was only then sent to us in terms of implementing that order or advise the client department to implement that order. What the applicant then did in this case, when they applied for the writ, we then approached the court that the writ was not issued in line with what Judge McCormick specified, but in the same time, by challenging that irregular process, we attempted to sort of settle the matter without dragging the matter. So where we are now, the matter is postponed until May, and we are busy. We're still in the pleading as stages on that matter. So that matter is still hanging. Now on the third one, again West Transvaal Security Services and the Minister of Home Affairs. The client department sent summons after judgment had already been granted. Now, in most cases, one of our battles, my two colleagues can attest to it, is that when we receive summons or when we receive a summons directly, we then send it to the client department request instructions on how to proceed with the matter. And now, in this case, summons were sent after the judgment has been obtained. It was just a question of compliance, but we were fortunate in that when the judgment creditor approached the court, it was before the 30-day period as prescribed in the judgment, and therefore they did not comply with that order. And we brought an application to set the matter aside because it did not comply with an interim order, and that order was granted, and therefore we also brought an application for rescission of that judgment. So that matter is still pending. The fourth one was where summons were issued against an incorrect defendant. And what has happened here, it is.
I'm laughing at that.
When we're instructed by the correct defendant, again, one of our challenges in terms of requesting further instructions, for purposes of filing a defendant's plea, we didn't get joy, but we ultimately had to withdraw as a turn of record, which consequently led to the plaintiff obtaining a judgment by default, and the warrant of execution was issued on the 8th of September. And then after the warrant was issued, then on the 1st of May, the client instructed our office to act on their behalf to resolve the matter. Then there was an amicable a meeting that was scheduled, and the client was then informed accordingly, and then we had to make an arrangement in terms of finalizing and settling the debt that was due, to which the applicant's attorneys were quite amenable to that arrangement. The last one is relates to where we have conceded on the merits, and therefore we had to settle the merits. And when the clerk of the court failed out to set out the notice with respect to arguments that could be led in court with regard to the quantum, we then received a notice of default judgment taken against us, precisely because the notice of the judgment was not sent to us and therefore were not in the position to advise the client department in terms of what steps to take. As we have the provisions now in terms of when a judgment is taken, the attendant record is still attending, need to notify the accounting officer in that particular department to ensure that that payment is made. But then an undertaking was made that stay the proceedings in terms of order of execution, because payment is going to be made. The Bloemfontein ones, the one that you see, those are all garnishee orders. Now, in our last discussion, I raised the issue that one of the alternative or possibility that we could speedily certify this judgment standing in money was because we're already paying advocate services and recover the same from various client departments to our agent services, and therefore we can also pay our the capital debts that is due, or the principal amount that has been claimed in that. The challenge is this garnishee order, because there is no way that we would know, because they said it, the attorney said it directly to finance sections and so on, because it concerns certain officials in the department rather than the state itself. So the Bloemfontein, there are all those garnishee orders against various officials in those various departments. On the Port Elizabeth ones, the majority thereof is...
No, I'm just not clear. I mean, the garnishee order is a personal thing. Why is the state involved? Why is the Department of the Premier? I mean, presumably, if you look at these Bloemfontein ones, presumably the debtor was Siate, and presumably he works for the Department of Local Government and Housing. But why is the department being cited? Is the department not, what would the word be, implementing the garnishee order on the person's salary?
Can I make a point and ask Mr. Loken just to explain the procedure and the challenges, why always we are faced with this, with this matter. As you can see here, this is one medical practitioner that rendered the service in respect of those of officials, and they didn't pay judgment. Default judgment was taken against them, and in terms of the rules, you can then proceed against the employer in terms of getting those deductions and so on. But the challenge is they then bring an order against a particular department to compel the department to comply with that order. But Mr. Logans can just further explain that thing.
Yeah, what would happen is the court would grant a garnishing order against attaching the emoluments due to the debtor, and if the employer does not comply with that order after it has been served on him, the creditor can then apply for a warrant, and he can then attach the employer's assets to satisfy the order. And that would seem to be what has happened here, is that the garnishee, which would be the provincial administration of the Free State, has not complied with the order, and now they're seeking to attach the assets of the province. The reason why the order is not complied with could be manifold. It could be that they serve it at some tiny hospital out in the sticks, and the thing never gets up to the central pay office. There could be all sorts of problems there as to why the judgment is given effect to.
So it's not necessarily what you're saying is it's not necessarily the relevant government department's fault. The problem could be the system, because I mean where I mean obviously I think the key thing is going to be the systems for instituting actually out the state. Because a lot of the problem seems to be people not knowing. I mean, I would hate to think what the legal costs. I mean, one would imagine that these are relatively small amounts of money, they're against personal individuals.
But yeah, let me come back. But I think what we're going to have to look very carefully at is the whole process. And I think where one is improving is the I don't know what the existing position is, but should there not be service in the provincial office of the state of Turkey? When not, I mean this bill relates more to when you want to execute a judgment. Should the process not start, if you need to actually get to the state that you have to actually serve on the provincial office of the state of Turkey? But maybe Mr. Gaul, I'm jumping the gun, I'm just sort of giving indication highlighting for consider.
Which goes back to the point raised by Mr. Vulcan that they'll serve it on some office and sticks. So as far as they're concerned, it's served. But the head office finance is not aware of it. So your proposal seems to make sense to me, but you know, you gentlemen are in a better position than I am.
Listen, I just want to point out that I think one or two commentators raised the same issue. For example, they indicated, okay, because the bullet present provides that the state attorney or attorney of record must within 7 days inform or give notice to the minister and the DG. What happens if notice is not given? So that's why I have invited these two gentlemen. We need to work out a process that, to provide that at least somebody must serve the court order or bring the court order to the attention of the state attorney's office. So that matter is, I don't want to say covered, but it has been raised by some of the commentators. So that matter will definitely receive our attention.
Okay, this bill is around executing when a judgment has already been obtained. And ensuring that then the money is paid up. What I'm looking at, and it seems to be because what's coming out here is that by that stage the situation already may have got complicated. So as Mr. Vulcan says on the issue of the garnishee orders, maybe service was on, maybe the relevant department was not aware of service, maybe default judgment was got without them being aware of it. So actually the first step is going to have to be rescission of judgment. The mafficking, the provincial legislature of Northwest is a case in point. It was clearly the wrong defendant. And the fault really, one would imagine, would be on the part of the service provider that provided the liquor. So, and then maybe you have it speculating, maybe you have non-lawyers in the speaker's office who think, well, this has nothing to do with us, therefore we're not accepting anything, even though they should contact the state law advisor, I mean the state attorney rather. What I'm really asking is should the process not start? If you want to sue the state, You can cite all the relevant people, but you must serve on the provincial office of the state law advisor at the start of the process. Because if we just limit it to where we're restricted to what we're doing in the bill here, then the damage is already done. A whole lot of legal costs have been incurred that are unnecessary. If you have service on the provincial state attorney, rather, I don't know if I'm meaning state attorney, even if I say state law advisor, even if you have service on the provincial office of the state attorney, I suppose the questions would be, do you have capacity to handle that, and what is the additional cost on the plaintiff, in terms of one also needs to bear that in mind. So you have a debt. You live in let's take Eastern Cape. You live in
well, let's take, okay, northwest. You live in in Taung, okay, that you then got to find your way to Mafeking to presumably find the state attorney's office and get a local correspondent maybe, or a sheriff or something. Whereas you could have got the local sheriff and gone to the Taung clinic, which may or may not be open. So it would be those two factors.
Thanks, sir.
I think Honourable Jeffrey's got a good point that we need to deal with the issue at the start of the proceedings for the reasons we've seen. I mean, we can't. It's going to cost a lot more money for everybody if you have a judgment taken in error against the wrong defendant. And I was also thinking perhaps we should look at whether we should cite or at least serve the final order on also the accounting officer of the relevant department, just in their official capacity, because they are ultimately going to be held responsible for paying that money or not paying that money, and if they don't know about it. So, may not be necessary if we have a satisfactory solution as far as the state attorney is concerned, and they have the obligation to ensure that that person is informed. But maybe we should discuss that at some point as well, as to whether that would be viable or not. And I take your point about the cost, but I think the cost of doing that will be far less than the cost of not doing it. No, I know. But I think the potential costs, if you don't bring it to the attention of the relevant department properly, will be far more in the long term than the cost of serving a summons or a whatever process on the actual state attorney. But I mean, at the end of the day, it looks to me that it is a process, and surely the process actually is the management of the department. I mean, surely there should be some kind of instructions in the department. If you get any kind of legal process, this is what you do with it. I mean, why do we have to even discuss this kind of issue here at this level?
We're being, I think, unfair on Mr. Gawula because he hasn't taken us. There might be other things in the document, one's going on the preliminary one. But what's shocking me is that the clerks of the court, whose job it is to deal with the court paperwork, seem to be at fault in some cases as well. Like this one Northwest case, the clerk of the court failed to forward the notice of set down on the quantum to our office and the default judgment was taken. Okay. Now, if that's widespread, you've got to then be, and it's one wonders what happened there and what's being done to correct that. But I think we're being a little bit optimistic if to expect instruction to departments to work. If the clerk of the court, who's actually dealing with papers the whole time, is not able to mess things up, then how can we expect some local office of a department to know what to do, and even a whole provincial department maybe? So I'm just want to raise that. That's also quite worrying.
I think the challenges that you're raising is what we're facing on a daily basis. And as I said previously, it borders on how the state in its entirety manages state litigation. That's for me the issue. And also we find these cases where the clerk of the court mess up papers in other serious matters, where a magistrate will issue a warrant of arrest against a wrong person. That person is put in prison, and so we're dealing with those things on daily basis. But without belaboring the point, in the Port Elizabeth one, in the Tyra matter, what the dispute, it was this common daily, where anywhere in the country where you find these rear motor vehicle collisions. And our challenge has always been, the law is very clear in those matters. And therefore, we've urged SAPS to settle those cases. For those cases, you don't need to oppose or go to court, because the law is very clear who is on the wrong. But sometimes we get instructions, my colleagues can attest to it, that we should defend. And then when we ask for instructions, the instructions are not forthcoming. And that has been a problem throughout. It's not only SAFs, but in this type of cases, where it is very clear that the defendant is in the wrong, you just settle the bet. Because what happens, you don't set it timelessly. On the interest, they even charge us interest from the date the debt was due. And you end up paying a huge sum. And in this case, the plaintiff's attorney followed the right procedure, but negotiations in terms was made in terms of not a commercial institution, because money was undertaken was made to settle and in effect the payment. In the Home Affairs one, these are matters where applications are brought to arrest and deport certain individuals for various reasons. Now, the applicant here brought a wrongful arrest and detention and claimed an amount of about a million rand. Judgment was granted on the 9th of May for an amount of 90,000. Now, what happened here is that when the plaintiff implemented the Nyati procedure to ensure that we satisfy the judgment that was made on the 19th, the plaintiff in fact did give us a notice that they're going to follow the procedures prescribed in the interim order by Judge Mokoro. But what is the problem is that the notice should have been sent to us. But then in this case, it was sent to the department, and the department failed to inform us that that notice was, a notice of attachment was sent. 1st of June, the sheriff then returned to the Province of Home Affairs and were instructed to remove certain computers. Then we tried to intervene on the instructing attorney to withdraw the attachment so that we can find a solution. Then everything was refused, and then our only option was to bring an application for rescission of that judgment. We then brought an urgent application to suspend the execution of the property, and consequently it was suspended pending the finalization of that rescission application. Application was granted on the rescission. Now the matter is still proceeding.
Yeah, just clarity on that. I mean, you know, there's reference in the document to following the Nyati procedure. Part of the Nyati procedure is there has to be a certificate from the clerk of the court or the registrar certifying that there's no appeal, review, or rescission proceedings. In this case, there were rescission proceedings. So how could that be done? The only thing I can think of is that judgment was on the 9th of March, and the writ was issued on the 13th of April. The whole issue of the Nyati judgment is 30 days. Were we late as the state? Was the state late in terms of applying for rescission? I don't know if Mr. Nkawula knows that.
Because it's interesting.
Obviously, look, the state could have been at fault and have been late. But if the state wasn't late, if the rescission had been followed, then the incorrect procedures were being followed by the sheriff and the court and the plaintiff's attorney. Should have been was there a certificate from the registrar that no rescission was being applied for?
These are some of those matters, as I indicated earlier, where it clearly shows that the dates are set out in the interim order
are not necessarily followed. And what you, and what we have done in this case, after trying to find a middle solution for both parties, which we were not favored with, our only remedy was a rescission application. And they couldn't proceed because, as required in the interim order, that an application was lodged, so they couldn't proceed in finally executing against immovable property. So that matter is still in the process. Now again, the following one is one of those subs matters. And again, our challenge is requesting further instructions and also urge land departments to pay urgently as prescribed. The next one is also one of those matters. And if you look at the amount, they're very minimal. But cumulatively, as a result of the delay in effecting that payment, it can escalate, including the cost. The next one is also an amount of 2,088. Again, what we can only do in our power currently is to urge them to pay. Otherwise, we have no further recourse against that. The next one again is the same is the same matter. To pay, but in this one, notice was given to follow the interim order in Nyati. Capital and the interest thereof have been paid. But the only dispute was in relation to the cost. And normally, if an applicant brings an application and want to settle and so on, normally the applicant claims cost in respect of those proceedings that they've brought. The last one was regard to the amount of 7,000, where they tried to follow the not follow the Nyati matter. And the applicant's attorney obtained a writ of execution outside the prescribed process and they removed the goods. We then tried to contact the applicant's attorney but to no success, because we have the view that the attachment was in itself unlawful, and therefore because it was in itself unlawful, because the procedure invoked was therefore outside the prescribed rule. But what we have done on urgent basis is to request the client to make the payment, and they made an undertaking that the payments would be made in April.
You make an interesting point there where you say some attorneys and sheriffs are not aware that there's a procedure that must be followed.
Yes.
But is that not true equally for magistrates? Because shouldn't the magistrate be aware?
My assumption, unless Ms. Gorkin and Mr. Manuel can state otherwise, is that the current interim order, it's like law as it stands until such time we've amended the current act, and therefore the magistrate, when they issue these orders, they are aware of the interim arrangements. I don't know, Mr. Okunu, do you want to make a comment?
I think the position would be that many clerks of the court would be unaware of the provisions of the order. I also think that in many instances it's never brought to the attention of the clerk of the court that the execution which has been sought is against the state itself. But even if it was, I do not know if the clerk of the court would pick up the implications thereof.
It's Mr. Lander's point. It's not the attorneys and the clerk of the court. It's the presiding officer. Why are they granting a writ of execution? Because this is the procedure that you follow, okay? And you don't do it, and then the judgment creditor may apply for a writ of execution. Why are the magistrates granting writs, given the Inyati judgment that they should be aware of, where there's no certificate from the registrar? And presumably, maybe it's something to look at in the Act, that you can apply. What are the time limits for rescission of judgment and noting appeals and things? But you presumably can apply for them after the 30 days have expired. Okay, so let's say the attorney for the plaintiff knows of this, does get a certificate from the clerk of the court that there's no appeal, review or rescission proceedings that are pending at that point. Applies for writ of execution, at which point the state attorney come in and say, no, we are actually applying for appealing or applying for a review or rescission of judgment. Presumably the presiding officer then, that's a basis for saying, no, you can't proceed with the execution. Because the whole thing is execution of uncontested matters. So even if you missed the 30, even if you didn't do it within your 30-day deadline, you do it afterwards. If it's still within, if it's still within a time that you can do it, that should be a basis for refusing to allow the attachment, because the subject matter of the dispute is not resolved. This process is for a case where it's clear cut. The money is owed. There's no defences. There's no appeals. There's no reviews. You therefore can proceed.
If I could just mention, the warrants aren't issued by the magistrate. They're issued by the clerk of the court. And the problem is that the clerks are not aware. Not all of them would be aware of the order. And as I say, many times the things just slip through. The warrant is just presented to them, and they sign it, and out it goes.
But then on that, what training? I mean, after Inyati, after Mokoro, what notices were sent out by the department to the clerks to say this is the procedure? I mean, how much is the department at fault for this lack of knowledge? Because I don't think one can blame sheriffs and attorneys. Well, maybe sheriffs because they're sort of quasi-government, but attorneys, if an attorney doesn't know the law, that's their fault and problem.
I think, Honourable Mr. Jeffries, the issue with Inyati, was brought to the attention of all client departments and in various of our, in all our courts, that is the procedure until we amend the Act. But I think the point that they're making, which I correctly agree, that in most cases, this is the clerk of the court. If you look at the Cape Town one, Salt Sales Agency, the clerk of the court issued that order contrary to Mokoro, arrangement. So that's what Mr. Wilkinson is saying, is that that's where the problem lies.
The thing is also, people's judgments are very often granted by the clerks as well. They're not magistrates, and even if they do, then they issue the warrants straight away. So you're not going to, at the time they issue them, there might well not be an appeal or a rescission application. That might only come in after the warrant of execution has already been issued. So it's not necessarily their fault, they're not.
And I think on this issue, as I raised with all of members in our last meeting, is the constitutionality of Rule 31.5, which empowers the register of the court to make orders in respect of immovable property. Judgment was delivered last week. That rule was found to be unconstitutional in the Gondwana matter, and when the process of amending that rule, we were happy as a department in respect of that aspect of that rule, where the livelihood or the shelter provided or by any citizen to have right to his house and so on is left solely on the hands of one person. And from that perspective, we welcomed that decision. Now, I'm raising that in the context of saying, besides the issue of training, shouldn't we look at the rule, especially magistrate court's rule, I think Rule 39, Rule 40,
is immovable. I think it's Rule 39, eh?
41. Rule 41. Where these orders are issued by clerks of the court, and see whether we cannot remedy the situation there in that regard. Similarly to the current unconstitutional Rule 31.5. The Breeder Valley one also here in Cape Town, where the clerk of the court again issued the order contrary to Mokgoro interim arrangement, and therefore we had to intervene, urge subs to pay the cost and to stop the process. Last one was a labor matter where the applicant applied for a post of assistant director in provincial administration of Western Cape. The requirements were set and the applicant did not have the necessary requirements, and therefore, because it was not shortlisted, he then sought an order liberal in amongst other to effect that was unfairly discriminated because of he didn't possess such license because of his visual impairment, and therefore he felt unfairly discriminated against. The matter was settled, and the provincial client department's recruitment department at this stage was urged to pay the cost, and the cost was duly paid. Therefore, the matter was settled, and all the processes that were initially invoked regarding attachment were then consequently withdrawn. It may not be all the examples that I've raised with you that we're experiencing, whether or not.
Maybe the information is wrong, but on what basis was there any settlement? I mean, basically he did not qualify because he didn't have a license. Therefore, he had no you know, I'm just I don't think we can just let this one go. I mean, even though it's not what we're dealing with, but it's basically I don't know why the thing was settled. I mean, if you look at it, the applicant applied for post in the province. Was the requirement that he have a valid driver's license, which he didn't have. He wasn't shortlisted for the post. What case has he got? And yet there's a settlement. Now, I mean, maybe
I would like to know what was the settlement. I mean, I don't know if the state attorney knows.
I believe the matter was settled, that the application was withdrawn and his costs were paid. He, in the interim, had applied for a higher post, I think, with the Department of Justice, which he got. The thing rather became moot. I don't know all the other...
So all the state paid for was his costs?
Yes.
Why did we do that? Why did the state pay for the costs when, I mean, that would imply there was some kind of fault on the part of the state. What was that fault?
I cannot speak to the merits of the case.
Can we get some kind of report on it? Because it just is, it's linked to the procedure. I mean, this seems to be straightforward.
Yes, it could
the guy didn't have a case, he should have been told goodbye.
It could have been on the merits, it could have been for economic reasons, I don't know.
I'm not following economic reasons.
Well, do you want to litigate when you can just pay the cost of that and go run the thing to the death?
But it just is that in this case it so seems to be so straightforward.
I just want to say the courts don't always take the same view.
Honourable Member, what I can do is to just get the facts, because it's in our state attorney, Cape Town office, and see on what basis did we pay his cost on the application that he brought, and then take it outside this meeting. Thank you very much.
I see the cost, the legal costs were 36,000, so that's sort of amounts that we're dealing with. When it comes to if we don't follow the right procedures.
Yeah. But Chair,
I mean, there's no mention of any role of provincial or national treasury in Mr. Gawula's report. They don't seem to have featured. I know Mr. Gawula is getting his information from the provincial state attorney's offices, but why is there no role? I mean, what does Treasury do, provincial or national?
Mr. Gawula, because I'm reading from the objectives of the bill, which says very clearly that the bill was prepared in close conjunction with National Treasury being the main role player. That's what it says here, Mr. Gawula. So their role is important.
You will see that because we act on behalf of the state, this is what we've been doing on daily basis. And if you look at all the 3A, B and B up to B, that's where we have tried to sort of try to stop these processes rather than allowing it to that to go to see where notices are supposed to be issued within 14 days to the provincial or national or national treasury in this matter. So our involvement was trying also to just to curtail that in terms of whether do they follow the correct rules of the procedure, is the debt due, and if it's due, let's settle the debt. But the challenge, once again, is that we can only go as far as informing the client department to settle the debt. Beyond that, there's nothing we can do.
Honourable members, we must thank Mr. Gawula and both Mr. Wilkin and Mr. Manuel. I must say I'm a little more confused now, and I suppose that helps.
All right. Before we proceed with you, Mr. Rabuskahni, I think I'm going to ask for a little tea break, and then we'll come back to you, okay? Okay.
You know, I'm going to go to the next one. Honourable members, I think we're grateful to Mr. Gawler and both Mr. Wilkins and Mr. Manuel, certainly from my point of view, to get a better understanding of the situation. as Mr. Labuschagne did warn me this morning, that it's very complex. Mr. Labuschagne, we're now in your hands. You had warned us that your input would take the better part of the day. Hopefully not. All right, let's see how far we can go before we break for lunch, and then do an assessment then.
Thank you, Chairperson. Committee members will note that, well, as I mentioned earlier, there are still some outstanding issues. Those issues have under responses underlined. And you see, in many of the cases, I need input from Treasury. So, which could then affect some of the proposals. But be that as it may, I will, during lunch, email this, my responses document, as well as my working poll to them, so that they can, in the meantime, between then and tomorrow, see whether they can give us responses. Because the document that they have submitted, or the last document, the last version of the document that they have submitted to the Minister for approval, basically address main issues, not some of these smaller ones. I previously submitted this document to them, indicated to them exactly where I want inputs. They haven't returned this document with the inputs, so I don't know whether they have done it separately, but some of these, or some of my requests for input, has not been addressed in the document that I believe has been submitted to the Minister. Because as that one basically deal with main issues. I'm going to pass all the proposals in respect of immovable property, because the committee has now taken a decision. Chairperson, on page 1, right at the bottom, the Cape Ark Council raises the question, how will the citizen know against which property they may not, he or she may not execute? Now what I've done is I've prepared a proposed amendment to subsection 5, that is on basically indicating that when a sheriff arrives at a department, the accounting officer or his or her representative must point out to the sheriff and say, but that you can attach, that you may not attach. So in other words, that right from the beginning, that we do not give the sheriff carte blanche, but that the department assist him or her in attaching property.
It was to get clarity on documents. There's a document, working document, is the 19th of the 4th. So the he says 3-8. That's on page 5 then. My page 4 has got 4, has got a 3-4, and 3-4-5-6. Okay, all right, okay.
Yeah, my concern obviously is that this is giving carte blanche to the accounting officer to decide to what it's going to be, and I'm not happy with that at all.
See, Chairperson, at the previous, I think when I gave the briefing initially, the question was raised, but who should identify what which property might be attached? And from that question, I thought, okay, let's try and create a mechanism right at the beginning. Instead of sheriff coming, attach, and then sub-clause 8, it seems that the department can then bring an application for stay of execution. So let's then
right from the beginning, try and find a mechanism to kind of avoid that further delay in bringing an application by the department. But that's for the committee to decide that. I mean,
thanks. I mean, I appreciate the, what's the word, creativity. I mean, but, you know, and I don't think it's necessarily a completely bad idea, but we need to have, I mean, it will obviously be subject to the specifications, the stipulations in the Act as to those criteria. But what happens if the accounting officer, just says, well, it's all necessary. Is there some remedy then for people, and isn't that going to then make it longer and more time-consuming and more costs? I mean, I'm just concerned. Is there any way we can tighten that up a bit? That's all.
I think it's a good start. But then the next step is what happens if the property identified is not sufficient to cover the debt. That's the key thing. So if the accounting, it doesn't really matter what the property is, as long as it can cover the debt. So if the I think it would be, if the one that the accounting, I don't know if one needs to say in writing, identified, because you see, you don't want a situation where the accounting officers or the officials are trying to stop attachment through trying to say that everything is going to disrupt things. So I think that you have it at the start. You try and get them to identify. I think, though, you need a clause that if they don't identify anything, then the sheriff can just go ahead and attach. Okay? And if if they do identify and the property is insufficient to cover the debt, then you need a remedy for that. And that would be my solution. So I think Mr. Lubskakny's point is a start. But you need to provide for, I think you need to provide for one, if they fail to exercise their opportunity to identify. Maybe you have it as a negative, phrase it in the negative. The sheriff can attach anything that the accounting officer does not indicate in writing is necessary, you know, would be disruptive for whatever, affect service delivery, whatever. So you can actually automatically attach anything. The onus is then on the accounting officer to say in writing, you can't attach this, you can't attach that, for the following reasons, yes. And then you need a remedy where if there's insufficient material. And I would have thought that remedy would be maybe going back to court, because remember this is clerk stuff, okay? So you then may be required to go back to court to argue the particular property is not affecting service delivery if it's attached. I mean, remember the other thing I'm just thinking through from the top of my head. Remember that it's an attachment but not a removal. So you may want to be more, maybe the system would be you can attach anything, and then you have a provision that if the accounting officer feels that property, the attachment, it then can't be removed, it can't be taken away. Where I'm heading towards is allowing stuff to be attached, and then there can be a battle later in court as to whether it's necessary, whether it should be removed or not. because it's affecting service delivery. Because you don't want a situation where, what I'm trying to avoid is a situation where you stop the attachment, the department then quickly ensure the removal of that property, so that by the time the court decides, no, that property was not necessary for the attachment and execution of that property would not have disrupted service delivery, that property has gone. But maybe there would be other remedies in that case. So, look, I think it's two scenarios, but the one, just to try and concretize it more, that sheriff can attach anything. Accounting officer or designee must then indicate in writing which property cannot be attached. And if there is insufficient property to cover the debt, then that would need to involve a court process that we need to provide for. The alternative would be attach anything, but you can't remove it. And if the department, the onus is on the department before there's any removal to go to court, apply to court to have property not attached, and then you've got the problem of what you do if you don't have enough money to enough property to cover it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the first suggestion about framing it the other way around, that the sheriff can attach anything other than what is designated. I think that's quite a good suggestion. But I'm not happy that people have to then go back to court again, because then it's going to end up in the same situation as Nyati, when they're going to go back and back and back to court fighting over what is able to be taken and what isn't, or what can be attached and what can't. Surely that second part, where if there isn't sufficient property, can be maybe dealt with by something we can discuss with Treasury tomorrow. Maybe that can be another option. It's just that for normal individuals to have to keep on going back to court all the time is just going to delay the process and increase the cost for them as well. I would prefer to see something like, yes, they can attach anything except what the accounting officer indicates in writing. And then make some provision that if there isn't sufficient, then it will avoid the situation where the accounting officer just says, well, everything's necessary, and then there's no money. Then we put another option in that Treasury would assist us with for payment of the actual money, perhaps. Because otherwise you're going to be in court forever.
JJ, there's also the possible situation where the DG says, well, okay, there's that 10-year-old coffee machine and that 15-year-old photocopier, and in the government garage there's a squirrel coro that's sitting on blocks. But all right, let's hear.
Well, I think it should be tighter than just the individual discretion. It would need to be reasonable, objective tests. So the accounting officer has it's not just his subjective view or her subjective view. It's an objective view that this is necessary, so that they can't just simply start saying no. The departmental car is necessary for service delivery. I think the onus on the discretion of the accounting officer needs to be limited, and it needs to be an objective test, not a subjective test. On the issue of, I'm just worried that Debbie is too hopeful of Treasury. I mean, Treasury are not going to come along tomorrow and say, hey, it's fine, we'll pay. If you can't find any assets, we'll pay. Don't worry, we'll pay. I mean, that's not going to happen. And that's not realistic to expect that of them. So I think the issue we've got to apply our mind to is what... I mean, to my mind, the only place that can arbitrate on the interpretation of whether property is needed for service delivery would be the court. Yes, you want to avoid a toing and froing, but it's a question of what are the other options. And unfortunately for Debbie, I just don't think an expectation, I mean, maybe I'll be proved wrong tomorrow, but an expectation that Treasury will arrive here tomorrow and say, no, it's fine, we'll pay. Got a debt, haven't got, we'll pay it. That there's some other, we've got to find some other way when there's not enough assets to be attached. I mean, it obviously could be that you could. We don't want to attach other departments. I mean, that's not right. But presumably, you could go and attach other offices, property in other offices. I don't know, but that's the thing we've got to look at.
Thank you, Chairperson. We must just keep in mind the law already contains a provision that states that sheriff may attach but not remove during that stipulated period. The department may be at application for a stay of execution. So that, the whole issue of that is on page 5, round about the middle. And I then also included, and maybe before I continue, in order to try and make it understandable for the committee, all my proposed amendments are double underlined and in italics. The reason why I've done that is because we're already amending an existing asset. It's difficult to work with just square brackets and single underlined. So all the wording in italics are my new proposed amendments. Whether it's in italics double underlined or italics and in square brackets, bold square brackets. Committing, I know that the notice isn't very clear, but on page two I tried to explain the way that we know this method. And then what I also then propose is that when any party having an interest, material and direct interest, applies to the court for a stay of execution, that party must then, as part of that application, indicate, okay, but in my view, you may not attach or remove those property, but you may attach these ones. But then again, we come to the problem if the department does not indicate. So we will definitely, somewhere along the line, have to create a mechanism, as Mr. Jeffrey said. If, number one, insufficient or the property attached is insufficient to cover the debt, or if the department or if there is no property. So we will definitely have to, and I don't know how we're going to do it, but it appears now that there is definitely a mechanism necessary to cover those kind of scenarios.
It's the old 4 and the old 7. I mean, who decides whether, at the way it's phrased at the moment, the attachment and execution of which would severely disrupt service delivery, threaten life, or put the security of the public at risk? Who decides that at the moment? The sheriff. As it's phrased at the moment, without your amendment. Okay, it's the sheriff. Now, what are the interests of justice that the attachment, the execution of the attached property is not in the interests of justice? What does that mean? So my thing would be, why don't we cut out, I mean, I don't think you can give the sheriff a discretion, because with the greatest of respects to sheriffs, they may not be the most free-thinking, creative people. Why don't we just simply allow attachment of anything? All right. Then, movable property, of course, yeah. Attachment of any movable property. Then, under 7, we amplify interests of justice to include that the execution would severely disrupt service delivery, threaten life, or put the security of the public at risk. Then, what you are doing is you're allowing free attachment, but in the event of a dispute, the onus is on the department to go to court, because I think the courts are the only body that is going to be able to rule around whether this is in fact property which will disrupt service delivery. and the onus is then on the state to go to court and allege that. So how's that for a solution? Yeah. I don't know if it's too hard on the state. I mean, I'm throwing things around, so.
Anything is in how long will that take to happen? And, you know, they could go back and say, well, everything is, and then the court decides, yeah, it is, and then what happens to the poor judgment date in the meantime? Because the court roles, as we know, are not exactly free-flowing either.
But this will be a motion courts. Not.
It will be an opposed motion, which is going to be set down for hearing, so.
But my problem in terms of what Debbie's raising is that I don't see any other option around. You've got to provide for. I think for me the principles would be you've got to prevent the attachment of property that is genuinely, if taken, would affect service delivery or threaten the lives of people. So if you want to attach dialysis machines which are in use, that's clearly not on. Okay, but the only body for me that is going to, unless there can be agreement, the only body that can determine whether a thing will disrupt service delivery or cause loss of life or endanger life would be the court, unless there's agreement. But if there's a dispute over it, it's only the court that can rule. But then make it a bit more difficult, the onus on the state to allege that and to go to stop the execution. So those would be the principles for me. How it's worded, I'm not too sure. Obviously, if there's no money, I mean, I think that's where one would need to look at a longer term proviso. I don't know what Treasury is saying, and we are maybe preempting tomorrow. But I don't think that that's going to get settled by way of attachment. There may be a requirement that the Minister of Finance or the MEC for Finance would have to approach the court and say what arrangements they're making to ensure that the debt will be paid. But that's something I think for tomorrow. Let's not go into speculating on that unless we can come up with some other grand idea. But really, what I'm saying is you do need the state to have the defence that this property can't be taken, but you don't want to make it too easy for them to use. What I haven't put out in what I've suggested is provision for if there's by consent that this property is its attachment or its execution would, if there's agreement by both sides on that property.
So presumably when you come to
the dialysis machine, it's obvious.
I'm just thinking on the current practice with regard to the Magistrates Court rules. We can make provision at the stage where the sheriff comes and he makes his inventory and put that property under judicial administration. It's only then the DG can just say, identify this property can be attached, this property can be attached at that stage, before the actual removal of that property has been made, because you've got to go back to court and make that an order of the court that particular property must be made. But there's an opportunity to say this property cannot be attached for this reason and so on, affidavit, copy given to the sheriff at the time when he makes the inventory.
Part of my optimism about Treasury was maybe not quite so optimistic, but it was more a question of them must inform us as to why the following scenario shouldn't happen. And my view is the first prize really is that departments should budget for legal action. They should provide, and they should estimate. We've got X amount. On average, we've had this amount last year and the last 5 years or 10 years, we make a provision for costs like in the event of judgment is obtained. Contingency liability, exactly. Now, I mean, I want Treasury to actually inform us as to why that couldn't be done, because I really think that that is the ideal. As it prevents attachment of any property. As soon as you get the judgment, they must just pay. At the same time, obviously, we don't want millions of rands to be sitting there not being utilized every year on the bed, you know, and it takes a case 2 or 5 years or whatever to finalize. But surely there must be some way where we can have this kind of contingent money available. And then only in the last resort we even resort to attachment property. And that is one thing I would like Treasury to say tomorrow, because I really do think that that is the best way of dealing with it if we can.
Adequate money in a contingency fund. That's the difficulty. And you see, one case, just thinking anecdotally, you know, there was that case on the Sani Pass Road where a New Zealander, I think, got severely injured in a car accident. And there was a huge damages claim against an amount awarded against the Provincial Department of Transport. It was a strange decision because I think the applicant, the plaintiff, was not wearing a seatbelt, and everybody knows that road is dangerous and so on. But let's say you get a sudden judgment amounting to millions, which is not in your contingency fund. That's why I would have rather thought of things like forcing the MEC for finance or the minister, depending on where it's appropriate, to explain to court what steps are being taken. Remembering, of course, it's ultimately Parliament that determines the budget or the legislature. But Chair, I don't know where we're going then on the thing, but I do quite like the idea. I think it was what Mr. Kaula was supporting it. Of allowing for attachment of anything unless it's something that the parties agree unless it's property that the parties agree that would be both the sheriff and the accounting officer, that the attachment and execution of which would severely disrupt service delivery, threaten life, or put the security of the public at risk. So we phrase it that way. And then under the old 7, the new 8, amplify that it's not just in the interests of justice, but allow allow that to be argued in court, and that would be dealing where there's a dispute over the thing.
May I refer to the period in which the application is to be brought? The section says you must apply to the court during the period referred to in the previous subsection. I think that should be deleted. They could bring the application at any time. Otherwise, you are restricted to that 30 days. There may be reasons for bringing it on the 31st day, for instance.
Then the sheriff might already have removed and sold the property. So that's why we said that application must be brought within 30 days before the sheriff removed the property.
There's a space of time between the removal and the sale. The sale has to be advertised and so on. I agree, once the sale has actually been effected, that's the end of the matter. But
if I understand it, you've got the sheriff comes and attaches. You've then got a 30-day waiting period.
Before the property can be removed and can be executed, can be removed and sold. Okay. The way it's worded at the moment is during that waiting period you bring the application. But what happens if on the 31st day
or the 34th day, because the sheriff was a bit busy. They then start moving to execute the property that was attached. Why shouldn't you, I mean, I think is the point, why shouldn't you at that point be able to bring a court application on, or the day before they do it, or the day they're doing it, to say, no, we need this property? The way it's worded at the moment, you can't, because the 30 days has elapsed. Obviously, once the property has been sold, it's sold. There's no point of bringing such an application, because the property is already gone. So I hear what Mr. Labuschagne is saying, but I think I agree with the state attorney's point that you do want to provide for on the 31st day, the 32nd day, or if the sheriff is just pretty lazy, the 60th day, if he hasn't executed yet, that we forgot this, we've just realized now that this property is the execution of this property will disrupt service delivery, and at the moment it's not there.
Person, if that's the case, if you can bring the application at any stage, do we then still need the provision that provides that the sheriff may attach but not remove? Because why can't he then immediately attach and remove himself? Because the applicant can at any stage thereafter bring an application.
But the risk.
You want to give the 30 days for the department to realize.
Can work slowly. That okay, the sheriff came in, they've attached this property. Hey, don't we need that property for service delivery? So you do want a breathing period, as it were. So I think the 30 days is important. It would have been nice to have given, from government's point of view, to have given more time, but from the public's point of view, you can't. So I think that's adequate. But it's just a small point. I don't think there's any real disagreement. It's just a small point that any time prior to the sale of the property, an application can be made.
That will also assist us, because if he attaches and removes, we would not have that opportunity for him to do evaluation to determine whether the property so attached and removed satisfy the actual debt. Whilst he attached, that property is placed under judicial administration. Then the next step, from the inventory that is made, an evaluation ought to be done to determine whether the judgment debt ought to be satisfied. So there's still ample time for the department to bring that application, to say, listen, this is in the public interest and security of the state and so on, rather than when he removes and attaches, we might not have that opportunity. It's the auctioneers themselves, it's the evaluators themselves. That's correct. Because what they do, for example, in when they attach and a private person, they will come to your house. Your fridge that you call for 20,000, they can put 1,500. And if you look at the amount, you say you own 50,000, they will have to clean your entire house. You would not have the opportunity to say no, this, except to say this property, movable property, fridge or whatever, belongs to a third party.
To be then in agreement that I delete in the proposed new subsection 8 the words during the period referred to in subsection 6, take up that, and should I then also insert it by bringing an application at any time before the sale and execution, or don't we have to go that far?
Would that not make it clearer? I mean, I don't know, state attorneys had raised the thing, but seeing we've had some confusion here ourselves, would it not be that the interested party, a party may at any stage during and prior to the sale and execution, bring an application?
Well,
I think I would leave it alone, but if you want to put something in, I would say something like before the attached goods are sold.
Yes.
Because you may want to bring the application while the sale is in process.
Yes. Why would, can I throw your chair, why would you leave it out? I mean, don't you think that given that we're hearing quite a lot of problems of people, whether it be clerks of courts to attorneys to sheriffs, understanding the law, wouldn't it be better to make the law as clear as possible?
Well, you're saying before the sale, which...
Your rewording, yes. I prefer.
Yes.
Why would you rather leave your rewording in?
I see it more from the state's point of view. I'd like to be free to bring it at any time.
you can't bring it after the sale.
Once the goods are sold, it's finished. Sale in execution gives good title, and
so
that's
so
it.
We're not really making new law. All we're
wanting is just a statement of the obvious to make it easier for people to read, and that there's then no confusion as to when you can bring it.
It's because I also foresee that you may want to bring the application while the sheriff is actually conducting the
sale. I've got no problem with that, but that's where your rewording of my suggestion I would agree with. And that's, through your chair, what I was just wanting to find out was, what's the problem with your rewording? Would you also qualify that by saying you'd rather leave it out? Or you?
That's really fine.
Okay. All right, okay. Mine is more just that I think we've dealt with that bit about when can this application be brought in, that it's not then subject to the 30-day period. Mine was more that maybe Mr. Labuschagne should respond if he's in agreement with it, and other members of the committee as well, is that all property is subject to attachment unless there is agreement between the sheriff and the accounting officer that this property is the attachment and execution of the property would severely disrupt service delivery, threaten life, whatever. Okay? So that's how we deal with, we amend sub 4. And then we amplify interests of justice to include one of the issues that you can apply to stop the execution of the property is that its execution would affect service delivery and cause loss of life. So it can be interests of justice but I'm still a little bit concerned about interests of justice, but at least put the disruption as one of the bases for an application to stop the execution.
So just for a matter of clarity, we must link, say, either in the interest of justice or link it to those three exceptions.
Yeah.
I just, in my document, I referred to a few cases where they have interpreted the expression interest of justice, and that also includes public interest.
Where
it's in one of the footnotes.
Requirements in sub 4.
I'm just not sure what the purpose of putting in interests of justice in the first place was. Can State Law Advisors just inform us? Because if you told me, I can't remember, but I don't... Why... What else could it be other than what those issues, you know, service delivery and people's lives and so on, what other interests could there be in the interest of justice?
Well, one possibility which occurs to me is that maybe you found that there was a fraud committed in obtaining the judgment and you want to set aside the judgment, which would then be in the interest of justice. That's just one possibility I can think of.
Also, the onus is on the judgment debtor to prove that that particular property is also in the interest of justice and therefore cannot be attached. Now, whether we were able to discharge that onus when a particular property is subject to restitution and consequential removal is something that we've got to think about as well.
Is raised about it by some people who make comments. Maybe we should just wait until we get to those comments and before we discuss it further, because I think it is in the document.
Sorry, I didn't quite follow Mr. Kavula's proposal.
I'm saying one is that at that stage when the inventory is made in terms of the execution, the Director General will then point out, as it requires in terms of the rules, which property cannot be attached. Now, it is then there where he or she can then say, you can't attach this property because of 1, 2, and 3. In other words, this property cannot be attached because it would not be in the interest of justice to do so. You see. So, what I'm trying to say is that the responsibility of the owners lies on the judgment debtor to do that at that stage. Now that property is immediately excluded unless when there's a shortfall, then we could look at what the rule says when there's a shortfall in terms of the property to be attached. Take into account there's a list of property that has been identified that cannot be attached because it will not be in the public interest to do so. Now what we need to look at is, after that list has been identified that property should not be attached because it's not in the interest of justice to do so, then automatically there comes the question of the shortfall, what remedy is available to the judgment creditor to deal with the shortfall. So when the issue of the onus, of the onus of proving, and there's opportunity to do so, unless they can challenge it. I'm writing that in the context of that exercise of pointing out which property can only be two problems. One, we've got property that belongs to the third party. This list, big machines that cost hundreds and thousands, which the state cannot afford, so we list it. So it's not the state property. But when you take 100 chairs, or 100 desks, or 100 computers, would that satisfy a debtor for R1 million in a small department? Now the issue is disruption of service delivery. If you remove those desks, if you remove those chairs, if you remove those computers, then comes into play.
I think we shall discuss the matter further after the committee has returned or later this afternoon. I don't want to waste the committee's time now on discussing this issue. Just one point, as far as Mr. Kavula has mentioned, the interest of third parties. The bill clearly provides property owned by the state. So third parties do not come into play. It clearly provides owned by the state.
Is it assumes owned by the state all property that is in the premises of the Department of Justice is owned by the Department of Justice, which is called the state, which is not the case. And now if you look at the rules, measure of rules, there are exclusions and explain the processes in terms of what the sheriff ought to do in that regard. Now, I'm linking that as the bill currently stands, that the property owned by the state, by the state, it is at that stage when the inventory is made that the DG or whoever delegated person to identify and say this property is excluded because of this reason, this reason, this reason, this reason. I'm just giving an example in terms of property that releases that doesn't belong to the state in that regard.
I mean, look, I would have thought that third-party property is something common generally in the issue of attachments and execution. So you have a private debt, you send the sheriff off to somebody's property to go and attach, and they attach the car that's on loan that actually belongs to your sister-in-law or something like that, okay, and that's provided for to deal with that. So I don't know if it is something we need to be addressing with the state, because it applies generally to attachment. I'm not sure what the provisions exactly are, but presumably a third party can object or whatever it'd be okay. But I think the point I'm wanting to just make, and I mean I know it's coming close to lunch. Where are we now and what are we doing? Okay, we're dealing with clause, the latter part of clause 3, so clause 3, 4 to 8. There were some clauses, because we seem to be following the Mr. Labuschagne's, what time did you say it was, your 7 a.m. document. But there were some clauses before then, which I think you haven't referred us to, you know, the fact that the executive must be cited, not may be cited. The issue around whether we need to provide for service on the state attorney, would that not come in there? I mean, I'm looking at the 1957 Act. It's a very short act. But it would seem that citing or service on the state attorney would come under Section 2 of the Act as well, and can we? So, Chair, what do we? Maybe it'd be better to develop in terms of after lunch. Are we going to go through the bill clause by clause, or are we using the 7 a.m. document?
Chairperson, I know this document is a bit confusing because it's jumping around, but I summarized the submissions by first commentator. So it was difficult for me to summarize, although not difficult, it's possible, but it would be quite time consuming to summarize all the comments relating to the specific subsection. But if the committee wants me to do that, and I think then we will be in a better position to understand. But otherwise we can leave this document, and I can just take the committee through this working document and explain to the committee the proposed amendments. But if we follow that route, I'm just concerned that we might miss other proposals. So I'm there.
I suggest, Mr. Jeffrey and Debbie and Advocate Adams, that we proceed as we initially wanted to, whereby Mr. Labuschagne takes us through his, as Mr. Jeffrey describes it, your 7 a.m. document, and then you highlight for us the critical issues there, all right? But that'll be when we come back after lunch.
Chair, that's fine, but his 7 a.m. document starts at course 3-4, whereas
The proposed amendments
document, as of the 19th of the 4th, which is today, started clause 2 with a must, the may becoming a must. So surely that's easy to dispense with. And then can we not, I don't know when was Mrs. Labuschagne going to want us to consider the May and the Month, because that seems, that's something not involving Treasury. And then can we at that point also consider the issue of a clause requiring service on the state attorney? And what does the state attorney think of that? That would be for any proceeding against the state. Is the state attorney in a position, maybe to tie these questions off now so you can consult over lunch, are you in a position to agree to such things now, or do you need to consult? That would be the main thing. What are the cost implications for yourselves that that you have to then accept service of every document where the state is being sued?
So I think we can answer those.
Yeah. I'm busy consulting with Amanda here. She was proposing we go to another venue after lunch, and I said, why? Protection of state information is supposed to be government, but my information is that they stay where they are.
Yeah, Chair, this chopping and changing, I mean, we had it last week with the public protector. It's not acceptable.
According to my, because I'm not supposed to be a member of that Adam committee, they're sitting in Mark's building. That is after lunch as well. There's no indication in the notice that after lunch they're changing venues.
Another point for discussion over lunch, I mean, and it's as much a question, I'm just asking in general, I'm not sure whether I'm concerned about it or not yet, but should we be allowing the sheriff and the accounting officer to be the ones who make the decision as to whether it's dangerous or life-threatening or whatever? What about the other party? What about the junk creditors? Should we not have some agreement with them too? Just to think about it a minute.
All right. Let's get back. Be back here at 2. Mr. Labuschagne.
Position.
Yeah, he's there. Can we leave our stuff here? Documents. Thank you.